Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today on the show, we're lucky to have Rob Browning, the head indoor and beach coach at St. Mary's College. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here with you.
So we wanted to start out, we actually wanted to cover a number of topics, but we want to start out with maybe a minor topic. I wanted to ask you about timeouts, because I've heard that you don't often use them, and I'm wondering if is that the case?
Yeah, you know what? I am not the quickest to use timeouts. You know, I won't call timeouts right away. And so, I think later than most. I talked to my team about a few things regarding timeouts. One, in volleyball, we have tons of stoppage time, and we're allowed to talk to our team between points. So, you know, I tell them, it's not like I've got some secret that all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, timeout, come over here. I just thought of something that's going to change everything. If I have something I want to tell them, usually, as we know, we have time to tell them between points. I'll call out timeouts when I think our team needs it and when I think it will help us. And I'd be really curious to know in a study what happens after timeouts. You know, it'd be very easy to do a study to see, you know, if point scoring or side out percentage goes up after a timeout or if it's kind of the same. Because when you call a timeout, of course, the other team gets a timeout also. And so, yeah, I don't call them as quickly as other people. But I definitely call them. And I think, you know, I have trust in my team. If I feel like they're fine, like, you know, they've lost a few points, but it hasn't been because of a lack of focus or a lack of direction or a lack of understanding of what they're supposed to be doing, then I won't necessarily call a timeout. I won't call it just because we've lost a few points. I'll call it if I think they need a timeout or there's something important we need to communicate or, you know, they just need to refocus or something like that.
Cool. And then I guess if you do call that timeout, are you just talking to the whole team? Do you have a coaching staff? Do you pull kids, players aside? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's never... I don't think it's ever exactly the same, you know. We don't, I'm not a big fan of, hey, the starters sit here and all the subs stand behind them and you put your arms around each other and everyone looks at the coach. I think, you know, what I tell my team is when I want to tell the entire team something, I want to have to tell you to be quiet. Hey, listen for a second. I want them talking during timeouts. I want them coming off the floor, talking and communicating with each other. We will pull individuals aside. I might talk to the coaches. My assistants might take the lead and I'll pull someone aside individually. It totally depends on what's going on. I think if a coach is calling a timeout and always addressing the entire team, you're probably not perceiving very well what is needed because oftentimes it may be one or two people. Sometimes it's just, hey, sit down and get a drink and relax a little bit. And then we'll give you one reminder or something and then get back out there on the floor. So, you know, I think it's always interesting. I think I'm not alone in this. I know a lot of us always think when we're watching a big match and especially a coach that's really well respected, we're thinking, gosh, I'd love to hear what he or she is saying. You know, it'd be so great to hear. And I think we almost always are disappointed, you know, when I'm, you know, with Carl McGowan, when I was with Carl McGowan or listening to Marv or Karch or Doug Beal or whoever it is, John Sparrow, it's like, yeah, there's no magic and there are no secrets. It's reminders about the scouting report or it's, hey, let's settle down or here's what we're going to do next. You know, let's focus on what's about to happen. So I think timeouts are important, super important. And I like to use them, when I think we need them. But our timeouts are never the same, you know, and I want them to be a little bit chaotic. You know, I want to get their attention. If the team comes to the sideline and they're not saying anything, there's trouble. You know, then there's a problem. If they're all quiet, then they're really not feeling very good about what they're doing out there. So I guess I like to see them talking, even if we've called it. Of course, if the other team's called it, it's a different situation, and our team's probably feeling pretty good because the other team called a timeout. But if we've called it, I want them to be relaxed and communicating, and I try and convey that to them.
Awesome. And I saw in my limited research for this show, I saw an interview where you mentioned, I guess, the term becoming your own coach. And I guess, how does one find their own style and voice? Is that important?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I do a lot of work with Gold Medal Squared, and I love working with those people. And I just, you guys know this too. I think it's just so fun to teach other coaches because they're so hungry and they want to learn. And so one of the things that we talk about a lot with Gold Medal Squared is that there are principles out there that can help you, help guide you in your coaching, but they don't dictate what you're going to do. They guide you in what you're going to do. And every coach needs to put their own spin on things, their own style, you know, inject their own style and their own personality into how they coach. It's so important. There were times, you know, I wanted to be like Marv, or I wanted to be like Carl, I wanted to be like Doug, or I wanted to be like someone else. And you quickly realize that that doesn't work, because so much of our own personality goes into coaching. You have to be yourself. So we're always, I think, good coaches, wise coaches, people who are learners, they take stuff from other people. That's how it works. You should be stealing things. You should be stealing, oh my gosh, that's a good idea, I never thought of that. Here's a little side story. I remember we went down to, Brent and Keegan and I went down to play at LMU, and Brent said, this is pretty funny, I've never told Tom this either, Brent saw something on their whiteboard and he's like, hey, that's a really good idea, we should do that, or we should, and so we're like, yeah, let's do it. And so we stole it and we started doing it, but eventually it becomes your own because you change it, you modify it, you tweak it, and you improve it, or at least you modify it to fit your team, your situation. And that's part of becoming your own coach, I think, is you learn from other people, but then you put your own twist on it, and you adapt it to your team. And so I think that's part of what that is, you know, becoming your own coach. It's not starting from zero or reinventing everything. It's taking what's out there that's good, learning and adapting it to your team and your personality and everything else.
And so what is your twist, and how's it different from someone like Carl or Marv or some of the great coaches?
Yeah, it really is different. First of all and foremost is because I'm not as good as them. So it's going to be different right there. But beyond that, you know, my practice, I was able. So when I was at BYU as a volunteer assistant coach, the staff was Carl, Hugh, and Troy Tanner. So how lucky was I? You know, I'm just a young coach in there just learning, you know, just watching these guys and learning. And then I spent a lot of time with Carl with the national team, did a lot of Gold Medal Squared clinics with him. And my practice does not look like his practice. There are a lot of things that are similar and the principles are the same, but we don't do the same things. You know, I'll take a game that I learned from Carl and I'll tweak it. I'll just do something different. I'll score it differently. I'll communicate it in a different way. And not necessarily, of course, that it's better, but it's just different. It's the way I feel comfortable doing it. You know, as much as I admire Marv, and want to be as good a coach as he is, I've seen his practices and my practices aren't the same, and I don't want them to be the same. They need to have my fingerprints on it if it's going to be effective, it's got to be, there's got to be something about it that I've put into it, that I've created, that I've added, that I've changed, because, you know, you have to be yourself when you coach. And so I think those things are going to change.
Do you think there are personality traits that are more effective? And if there are, should we try to change our personalities?
I don't think we should change our personalities. I remember when I was a really young coach, I was coaching boys out in Fairfax, Virginia. That's when I first started coaching volleyball. I started a boys club out there, and I had all these boys who were super into volleyball. I mean, we'd practice for 2 hours, and then I'd try to get a hold of them later that evening, and I'd call their home back before cell phones. And the parents say, oh, they're at the rec center playing volleyball. I mean, they just played all the time, and they got to be really good. But there was a kid on the team who was kind of quiet, and I always, you know, was trying to get him to be more demonstrative and to yell every once in a while and to, you know, this, that, and the other. And after a while, I realized he was very effective doing what he was doing and being himself. It was not his personality to yell very much or to, you know, communicate loudly or to kind of wear his emotions or show his emotions outwardly. And I think the same thing goes with coaching. Yeah, you have to have your own personality. You have to be you. And we can all think of coaches that we think are amazing coaches. And if we list 10 of them, they have their styles can be completely different. Some of them are, you know, very quiet. I remember a famous quote from his name Dungy, the football coach.
Yeah, Tony.
Tony Dungy. He was talking to his team and he said, you know, at the beginning of his career or with a certain team when he first started out, he said, "This is as loud as you're going to hear me yell, you know, as your coach. I'm not a yeller and a screamer. This is it." And that's, you know, that's football where yelling and screaming is quite popular. So, but you know, we can think of coaches and they have different styles. Bernardino is frantic on the sidelines. I mean, his personality is so out there and vocal and emotional and everything else. And other coaches, you look at Hugh McCutchen and it's very different. It's very calm and Karch is different and John Sprague is different and Mary Wise is different. So I think you have to, you can be just as effective, but you have to be yourself and your personality is who you are. And, you know, of course, we always want to improve things like, hey, I don't like this aspect of my personality. I'm going to work on that. But we've got to be ourselves on the sidelines. And I still struggle with that at times, especially when my team's not doing well. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to be calmer. I'm going to be more vocal. I'm going to stand up more. I'm going to sit down more. I'm thinking, how can I be a better coach, especially during a match? And then I always come back to, you know, just be yourself. That's when you're your best, when you're at your best.
Good advice.
And there are a lot of great coaching resources out there, Gold Medal Squared included. How does a new coach judge what to follow and what will work for his or her team?
That's a great question because there's so much out there now. I mean, you can obviously just go on YouTube and
some crazy drills.
Anything crazy stuff's going to come up and you might find something good and then you're going to find a bunch of stuff that's really random. So I think a young coach needs to go to some trusted sources. It's okay to go on YouTube and check stuff out. I think if you want to learn, you're going to look everywhere. You're going to look everywhere to learn stuff. But eventually you have to go to some trusted sources, whether it's some coach in your area that has been coaching for a long time, has been successful, and going to watch their practice or pick their brain or something like that, or going to a good, you know, coaching clinic, any coaching clinic, you know, it doesn't matter really what coaching clinic it is. I don't think so much as long as the people there are people that have a reputation of excellence. But I would encourage, you know, coaches to try to go to different sources to learn and keep going back. The coaches who I admire the most and the ones who are the most successful, even the ones I know very little about, like Gino Auriemma, you know, you read some stuff about him, you hear him talk, and you think, wow, this guy's really impressive. But all of those coaches who are so successful, they're constantly learning, right? Don't you think? Don't you guys feel that way? Like Marv, Carl, Hugh, Karch, they always want to learn something new. They're always questioning and revising and revamping and changing and tweaking. And I think that's one of the reasons that it makes them great. So even, you know, we start off as young coaches not knowing very much, and we go to trusted sources, and you got to keep going back and going back and talk to different people and just keep learning. I think one of the things you always want to feel as a coach is, man, I wish I knew back then what I know now. You know, I always think that even 3 years ago, man, I wish I knew then what I know now. Because if you're saying that means you're learning. If we're saying, oh, I know just as much now as I did then. I knew everything then. I know everything now. We're not learning a whole lot. So I think that as coaches, we always want to be able to say that to ourselves. I wish I knew then what I know now.
Yeah, and we totally agree that you should always be learning new stuff. I'm sure all those coaches do. Have you ever had moments in season where, you know, you're searching out this new information, or you're always trying to learn, and maybe you're trying some new drills or strategies for your team that just aren't clicking? Maybe the players are kind of, I don't know, frustrated with the consistency of stuff changing. Like, how do you deal with throwing a lot of new stuff at them?
Well, we deal with that by not doing it. Mm-hmm. We don't throw a lot of new stuff at them. We will change some things. And I don't know, if you talk to my players, maybe they would say, no, he changes stuff too much. But I don't think we do. We stick pretty close to what we feel works and, you know, what's been proven to work for us. But we do change things. I mean, we tweak things and make adjustments and modifications fairly regularly, but it's not the kind of thing where the players are thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we're doing things totally different now. I've had a lot of assistants, too many recently. Like, I always feel like I'm hiring a new assistant for one reason or another. They're moving on to another job, or they're, you know, whatever. And so that's been hard, but there's a good side to that too. You know, there's a good side to hearing different perspectives. I've been fortunate to have really good assistant coaches, and so it's good. I like having an assistant that comes in and has new ideas. And so when that happens, things will change, because I put a lot of faith and trust in my assistant coaches. I've hired them because I think that they are capable of doing a really good job. And I want them to feel very empowered that they, you know, anytime in any practice, they can go out there and stop everything and give feedback and come to me and say, hey, I think we ought to do this, or, you know, let's try this, or what do you think about this? And I will oftentimes listen, and we'll try things, you know, subtle little changes and differences. And I think the players, you know, we've got to teach them to be able to go with that and to be learners themselves. You had, is his name Paul Ratcliffe, the soccer coach, on recently?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was talking about adaptability and improvisation. And players need to learn that. They need to learn to adapt and learn new things and improvise and go with it and be resilient. You know, hey, yeah, we're changing this, and you need to embrace it. It's going to be difficult, but the only reason we're changing anything is because we think it's what's best for the team. It's going to make us better. We don't change things just to change things. We change them because we think it's going to make our team better. We think it's going to make you better. So here we go. Let's go for it. It's going to make you uncomfortable. It's going to be different. There might be a little learning curve here, but there's a reason for it. So let's do it.
Can you take us inside a St. Mary's practice and maybe if you have an example of a drill that you learned from a mentor like Carl that you've made more your own, if you can take us through that.
Yeah. So a practice for St. Mary's, an indoor practice, is the teams out there, you know, on time is early, and they're out there doing some exercises and getting themselves ready. They do some band work, you know, some injury prevention and warm-up kind of stuff with bands. And they do, you know, they might do some core exercises, but pretty quickly also they're doing footwork patterns, blocking footwork or serving and passing. You know, they'll start off just behind the 3-meter line and they'll just serve to their teammate and get their arms warm, but also practicing serving. Of course, we put a big emphasis on your warm-up is making you a better volleyball player. Doing band work isn't making you a better volleyball player, but there's some things like, hey, you need to do this before practice starts. It's going to be good for your shoulder. It's going to be good for your, you know, your glute meads or whatever it is. You got to do this stuff. But really quickly, they're doing things that are making them better volleyball players, like doing blocking footwork or serving and passing. You know, the setters are setting right away. The passers are passing. So, yeah, we'll go through that and do some skill work. And then at some point we're getting into some kind of a warm-up game or a really competitive game. And we do a number of different games, and some of them are exactly like I learned from Carl McGowan in 1998, you know, offense wash defense, doing a game like that. It's exactly the same. Or some have my own, you know, Carl wouldn't really recognize them. You'd look at him and he would have said, you know, what's this? I've never seen this before. A game that we really like that I've done a lot recently. And I did a session at the AVCA and I showed this game just because I really like it. And we've done it a lot. It's called First to Three or First to Four, whatever, if we want to push them a little harder. But it's basically serve a specific player, and there's two players that are going head to head. Maybe it's a right side hitter against this left side blocker who's a left side hitter in transition. And you have to serve one of those people or the libero if that hitter is not a passer. And you have to set that player. You have to set that player no matter what. If that player can't attack it, then you have to bump it over with your forearms past the 10-foot line. Basically, you have to give the other team a free ball if you can't get the ball to that player. And if whoever wins the rally gets the next ball really quickly and they try and put it away. And we have some rules about if it's the first ball off the serve or the toss from the coach, it's one-on-one. There's only one blocker, but in transition, the middle can also help block. And so it's really this kind of head-to-head competition. It's a really good, very competitive game. And so these two players go head-to-head, and the first one to win three or four wins that game. And then they switch sides of the net and they do it over again with exactly the same teammates or the opposite teammates. You know, on one side, I'm with one setter and one libero and so on and so forth. And then I switch sides and I'm with the other team and they play the game over again. And that's a game, you know, that's a game we'll put in the books and say, Lindsay and Sarah played against each other and Lindsay won this game 6-4, and we move on to another position, you know, two other players, two middles, and then two other sides. So it's the principle of the game is that it's game-like, it's easy to understand and to play. There's a scoring method and some restrictions on it that get so that you get out of it what you want to get out of it, and that you keep score and you keep track and you record it so they know that it matters, that when they're playing this game, it's game on and it's going to go in the record books. And so we want that to motivate them to play hard and really go for it.
Is competition often play a big role in developing your players?
Yeah, I think it has to. For sure it has to. There are times when you're learning, and sometimes I'll call that the laboratory, you know, where we're getting reps and we're learning. And so when we're in the learning phase, we want our athletes to go beyond their circle of comfort, you know, to really push the boundaries and to be doing things they're not very comfortable doing, that they're not very good at, but that they know they need to get good at, whether it's hitting down the line on the right side. I, you know, a player is not good at that. Okay, now's your time to practice. You got to do that. And you're going to make mistakes doing it. And you've got the green light right now to make mistakes. That's what we're do. That's what this activity is. And so sometimes I'll call that a laboratory, you know, where you're experimenting with stuff. And then you get into competition. And one of the things that Michael Gervais, you know, I know taught the national team and talks about is you go outside your circle of comfort when you're trying to learn new things and improve. But when you're competing, you kind of want to be in that circle of comfort. You know, you don't want to be trying new things or getting outside your comfort zone so much. You want to just take what you've got, be the player you are. This is what I've learned. This is what I've got. And I'm going to use it to win. So, but along with that, you know, when you're competing, there are certain things we're trying to get our players to learn so that they can win more. And so if they've been doing something that's not effective and it's keeping them from winning more, we'll encourage them, hey, in this game, you got to start doing that thing you've been working on. You got to get your arms back. You got to be balanced when you're passing. You've got to hit this flatter serve or whatever it is. You got to go for it because you're going to win more by doing that. So maybe that's going a little bit towards the edge of their ability level. But competitiveness or competition, I think, is very important. And Paul Ratcliffe talked about that also in that podcast that you just did with him. He talked about it's one thing to do passing drills. It's another thing to do a passing drill with a defender on you where you have to make a decision. That's really the motor program you want them to learn. If they're just doing an isolated, blocked passing drill, they're not really learning the passing they need to learn. They need to learn it with a defender on them. And so that competition is super important to get them to learn how to win and to learn how to implement the things that they're working on in their technical instruction, you know, or technical reps.
Man, Rob, I thought you were just being nice when you said you listened to our podcast, but you're like remembering them.
I like them. I like them a lot. And it's fun, too, when you know some of the people, whether it's David Hunt or whoever, you know, some of the people who are in them. It's fun to listen to.
So John Mayer and I sneak into your gym and try to steal some information from your whiteboard. What's something on there that we would take away and use?
What's something on there you would take away and use?
You kind of went through a practice plan. Is there anything else? I don't know. Any quotes you guys have?
That's kind of unique?
Yeah.
We're always throwing quotes up there at the top of the whiteboard. But what's unique? Yeah, I mean, the quotes that we put up there are quotes that, for the most part, you're familiar with. And sometimes it's not a quote. It's just a reminder about something, whether it's having a growth mindset or being proactive or something like that, something that we want, that's a core value that we want to embrace and that we talk about often. It's always good to give those reminders at the beginning of practice, one specific thing, like, whatever that might be. But sometimes it's a new quote, of course, something that may be relevant to our situation during the season, might be relevant to something that's happening. Martin Luther King Day, I'll throw a quote up there from Martin Luther King because he's got a bunch of great quotes about, about life or learning or being a better person or whatever it is. So it kind of depends. But what would you find? One of the things we do on our whiteboard that I think is really important to do and really good is we'll have them on the back of the whiteboard. We will have them write down their controllable, really short-term goals. Like this is what I'm working on right now. I'm my goal is to have a really good finish when I set, or to make my hitting approach, slow to fast. I'm working on my slow to fast approach, and I'm trying to perfect that. And actually what I started saying this year was, these are no longer, we're not calling them goals anymore. We're calling it a to-do list. What is on your to-do list? Because they weren't changing fast enough. You know, we'd talk to some player and say, hey, this has been on the board for 3 weeks now, and I can see that you haven't achieved this yet. You need to get this done and move on to something else. This needs to become a habit and not wish list. So I said, this is now called a to-do list. Get it done, change this little thing you need to change, check it off your list and get it off your list and put something else on there. So you're making progress. And I was pretty proud of myself for that. I thought that was pretty clever.
Thank you for listening to Coach Your Brains Out. Join us next week for part two of our conversation with Rob Browning. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. This is part two of our conversation with Rob Browning. So I'm told that you've studied serving quite a bit. What are some keys to good serving?
I talked about how in warm-up, you know, our arm warm-up is serving. Because it's a warm-up, it starts with just standing and hitting a floater over the net. And so, you know, we talk about a float serve. Why do we call it a float serve? Because it floats. How does it float? It floats when there's no spin on the ball, right? So that is a skill that you have to be really good at. You have to learn how to hit the ball with no spin. And so, especially when we're teaching younger kids, you know, at camp or whatever, I've made that a principle. That's no spin is a principle. It's a, what is it called? It is a law of physics that if the ball is not spinning, the air will interact with the seams on the ball and yada, yada, yada. And all of a sudden the ball will start floating. But if it's spinning, it won't float. So no spin is really important to having an effective float serve. So that's key. And they have to learn how to do that. So we'll talk to them about what's the easiest way, the best way to hit the ball so that you can hit it with no spin. But I, you know, serving, the things we all know about serving, you know, that you really control everything about it. So there's really no reason why you student athlete shouldn't have a great serve. Why is your serve not great? You get to practice it all the time. You can practice it on your own. It's kind of the only skill you can really practice on your own. And so we put a lot of emphasis on it. But hitting it flat, hitting it with no spin, being able to hit with range, some little axioms we use are, you know, things to remember, like aces happen. We say aces happen. You're not going to go serve. You're not going back there thinking, I'm going to serve an ace. You're going to go back there and hit another good serve. And every once in a while, it's going to float or hit a seam or something good's going to happen. And you're going to get aces out of it. But you're not going for aces. You're just going for good after good after good. You're going to hit a good serve consistently. It's going to be flat. It's not going to have any spin. You're going to be a master at changing velocities and hitting locations. And you're going to be able to hit a short serve and a flatter deep serve and have those little changes to it. But basically, you're just going to hit a good serve over and over again, and good things will happen with it.
I like that. Aces happen. I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to go aces happen whenever I serve Billy. No, just kidding.
Not true.
I think that's pretty
aces
true.
Aces happen. Yeah, no. We talk about you serve. Carl used to say, serve a seam, serve an ace. Of course, it's not that simple. But if you can serve the seam more, aces are more likely to happen than if you serve it right at someone. There's just those little things that increase your percentages of being an effective server.
Right. So when you teach serving, do you spend less time focusing on technique when you get closer to a competition? Do you focus more on the mental parts of serving, or are you always trying to upgrade technique?
No, not always trying to upgrade technique. I think it's interesting, though, how even really accomplished players who you would say are masters at things, they can sometimes get away from some of the things that got them there, you know, and all of a sudden maybe they're trying to do too much. And so things have changed, and then their serve's not as effective. And you got to kind of, you know, you watch, say, hey, notice that you've been tossing lower recently. And I think because you're tossing lower, you're starting to get a little bit of backspin on the ball. You're not hitting it as cleanly or whatever. Let's go back to, you know, how you were serving. You know, take a look at this. Watch this video. What do you think? Yeah, it does look like I'm tossing lower. And we've been looking at your stats recently, and your serve hasn't been as effective. Maybe that's one of the reasons why. Let's go back to what you were doing when you were successful. But with serving in particular, you kind of want to, you know, you want to have your serve. We talk a lot about hit your serve. And we throw all the serving rules out the window. Don't miss after a timeout. Don't miss on game point. Don't miss if your teammate missed before you. Don't miss if you missed your last serve. I believe very strongly that that's not what great players do. Great players don't think, oh, I can't miss right now. Great players think, I'm going to go hit my serve, and I'm going to be aware of the situation, and I'm going to be aware of what's been happening and how I feel, but I'm just going to go hit my serve, the one I've trained to hit, because the serve that I've trained to hit is one that has an appropriate level of margin of error. Like, you know, it's a safe enough serve, but it's not an easy serve. It's a good serve, and great athletes can step up when it's match point or, you know, a lot is on the line or whatever, and go hit their serve. I think the worst mistake you can make is the mistake of being too careful or trying to change something. You know, I heard a coach recently say, don't miss your serve. You know, you can't miss your serve right now. The chances probably just went up for that player missing the serve, especially if they're not super confident with it. Just go hit your serve. And your serve already has built into it that you can make it 19 out of 20 times in the court. And it's a good serve. You know, it's kind of tough, but it's not very risky. It's not high risk, but it's effective. And so, you know, we talk to our players about that. We want them to have their serve and know what that means for them. Go hit your serve, because the serve for this one athlete is different from the serve for this other athlete. Know what your serve is and go hit it, and hit it in all situations, and good things will happen.
Cool. I like it. And you've developed a very successful beach program at St. Mary's, and it's composed mainly of indoor players. Have you seen it benefit the development of your indoor players playing beach?
Yeah, in lots of ways it has, for sure. And so first, it'd be important for me to say that I've been very fortunate to have great coaches helping us with our beach program. Dallas Dodd was on our team when we started playing beach. So we got Mike and Patty, you know, and they were teaching us basically how to coach, and they helped coach our teams as volunteers. And so that was awesome. And there's some things I'm amazing at. One is hiring people. Like, I hired Angela Rock last year for beach volleyball, and I'll brag about that forever. She was awesome. She was so good for our team, and our girls loved her, and she brought in, you know, all these expertise that she has, and a little different viewpoint and take on things than Mike and Patty, who were so good at teaching our team. And then also, we happened to get some indoor players who are really good at beach volleyball. They were good before they even came here. So that's been great for us. But the ball control, I think the things that are obvious is it helps with your ball control, you know, for an indoor player, whether that's with your platform or with your hand, you know, having some shots indoors also, you know, like I can kind of hit this sharper angle because I know how to kind of cut the ball and slice it a little bit more. But I think the things that I wasn't as expecting as much maybe was the mental side of the game, you know, because you can't hide out there on the beach, right, guys? You're exposed, and hey, they're serving me every ball, and I've got to step up. I'm not going to get subbed out, and I can't step out of the serve receive formation. I've just got to do it. So I think that's really good for him. And reading the game, of course, I think it really helps them just read. In the beach game, they learn how to read because they're constantly having to do it. And so they're looking, you know, we teach them, of course, to look at the right things, to pick up cues on what's most likely to happen next and how you're going to position yourself to be successful when that does happen. And, you know, the conditioning aspect of it is great. So, yeah, there are a lot of things about it that help. It's not all, you know, the whole list isn't, hey, all these things are going to make us an indoor team, a better indoor team, of course. Our setters are not getting any better at setting an offense. Our middles aren't getting a lot better at being a middle specifically and making those block moves. But I'm really happy with what it's done for our players and how it's made them better. But the thing that's, I think, is best and I'm most happy about with having our indoor team play beach is it enhances their student athlete experience tremendously. And John, you know that the girls who are on the indoor team are playing on the beach team. I mean, they love it. And instead of just being in the gym for 4 months and lifting and running and doing open gyms and getting some training in there, they're getting this different experience. And I've talked to so many former student athletes who just say, man, I wish I could have done that when I was in college. And then the other thing, some players who don't play very much indoors, you know, there's some players on our team who don't get on the court very much. And maybe on the beach, they're on the fives team and they're playing a ton and their game matters as much as any other game and their parents get to come watch them and the mean old coach isn't going to sub them out because he can't. And so it's great for that too. I think there are a lot of positives to it.
Do you teach different fundamentals for like passing, serving, attacking on the beach versus indoor?
Basically, no. You know, I think the fundamentals are the same. But yes, there are, of course, some nuances that are different in setting, for example, and just some of those things, I think, yeah, are different. But I think the fundamentals are the same. You know, hey, we want you to hit a flat serve with no spin, and we want you to be able to hit seams, and we want you to be able to have a good short serve. And it's fun, though, having a lot, you know, getting athletes to hit their jump serve, for example. We've been emphasizing that a lot more this year and trying to get more of our players to hit serves with spin when conditions are good. And they really like it. You know, it's really fun for them to do that. And when they would never do that indoors, because, you know, it's not as effective indoors. You have to crush it indoors for it to be effective. And out on the sand and on the beach, if you've got some breeze, you don't have to crush it. You just have to put some spin on it and hit it in a good spot, and the wind will do some good things with it. So, yeah, there's some things that are different, but I think, I don't know what, I'm curious to hear what you guys think. Are the fundamentals the same? The fundamentals are, I mean, they're not, it's not like, hey, passing on the beach is totally different.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people think they're different, but to me, I think they're the same. I think a good angle towards your target is good indoors or on the beach. And yeah, I think a good contact on your float serve is good indoors or on the beach, and a good slow to fast approach is good either way. So I think they're way more similar than different. I think the strategies are where it gets a little different, but right. Yeah, I think that's why the sports can be united, if I think people accept that more often.
Yeah. So for example, one of the things we learned from Mike and Patty that was so good is playing narrow. You know, if I'm going to pass, I'm not passing over to that side of the court. I'm passing in front of me, right. You know, maybe just inside my inside leg. And so that's different from indoor. If I'm playing left back indoor, I'm going to create a much sharper angle to get it over to where my setter is going to be. Whereas on the beach, I'm going to pass in front of me more. But the fundamentals of passing, of getting the ball to go there, are the same.
Right.
You're going to set your angle so that the ball goes to that spot. And so that's an example to me of how they're different, how things are different, but the fundamentals of how you execute those things and get things to happen are really very similar.
Yeah, I agree.
And in some cases, the same.
And does a beach practice structure vary much from an indoor practice?
I think it does. I've been having so much fun this year because most years I have not either been involved very much in coaching or just been an assistant coach. Last year I was Angela's assistant because that's where I belonged. I wanted to learn from her and she was in charge and that was great. And when Mike was there, he was, the head coach. And oftentimes my assistants have been the head coach and sometimes I haven't even been on the coaching staff. But after 4 or 5 years, how many years it's been, and having those coaches, it's been so fun for me because I just feel a little more confident now and comfortable out there running a practice and setting a practice up. Mandy, my assistant coach, is better than I am at coaching beach. She's really, really good. And she and Jordan Shaw were our head coaches a couple of years ago and did just an outstanding job. And she's in so many ways just a better coach than I am. It's really fun to work with her. But I'm the head coach this year and it's been fun. It's been great. So a beach practice, yeah, I think is for sure structured differently. But again, it's going to sound repetitive. I think the principles are the same. You do your warm-up. Your warm-up needs to be game-like. When we're warming up, we're getting better at volleyball. We're not just running around. We're doing things that are going to make us better at volleyball. And we'll kind of do some skill work, and then we'll do some competitions. And so it's definitely different. But one of the activities we really like to do indoor is called ball setter, ball hitter. You both are probably familiar with that activity. So it's a really good activity. It's a really good laboratory where, hey, we're going to work on stuff. We're going to give you feedback. We're going to watch video. And we're going to put you in situations where you've got to get yourselves outside your comfort zone and get better at some things that you need to get better at. And so I started doing that on the beach. I was like, why can't we do this on the beach? The defensive team tosses a ball to the coach and the coach passes a variety of passes and watches the blocker to see if the blocker is making the right read off of the set, knowing when to drop or when to stay and block. And you're also working with the offense, here, I'm going to give you this bad pass. And are you getting your body behind the ball to be able to set it effectively? Is the attacker positioning herself in a way to make it easy for her partner to set her and stuff like that. So that's something I stole from the indoor games. Like it's great for indoor. It should be great for the beach. And we really like doing that. So same kind of answer. I think there's so many things that are similar, but the game is definitely different. And yet you have to be aware of those differences. And that's where Mike and Patty and Angela really helped us a lot. Helped me especially see, hey, this is not the same game and you've got to be aware of these things if you're going to be a good coach out on the beach.
So you've been around the college beach game now for a number of years. I'm wondering if you have ideas on how it can be better, how it can continue to grow and improve.
I wish they had a Paris championship, the NCAA, that would be really cool. Don't you think? I wish they had that. Hopefully they will be open to that in the future. I think it's just going to continue to grow. I really don't have any unique ideas, fresh ideas about, hey, we should be doing this or we should be doing that. I just think it's great, and I think it should continue to grow. And I think, it's just a matter of time before it's really deep and entire conferences have everyone playing beach. And the championship is a lot of teams and not just eight or however many it is right now. And they have a pairs championship. I think that'd be great. I wish, you know, boys and men's volleyball is really getting a raw deal, and it's really sad. It's just tragic how boys and men's volleyball has been affected really by the implementation of Title IX. Title IX is great, and the purpose of it is good, but the application of it has been so detrimental to men's volleyball. It's great seeing men's volleyball grow in the Division III schools. You know, it's so good that USA Volleyball or the NCAA or whoever it is has been identified. Let's find ways to get this to grow and making that happen. But wouldn't it be cool if we had beach for men, collegiate beach? Why not? And the answer to that question to why not is because of Title IX, but it'd be great if we can figure out a way to get beach volleyball for men. I mean, John, how great would that have been to be able to do both, or maybe do one, or
I would have loved
the
it.
Other, but
yeah, I hope it starts on like a club level, like it is indoor for the men.
Has that already started?
I don't think it has, but
it hasn't.
I don't know. I hope it does. Yeah.
Totally should. Yeah.
Maybe we'll get it going at LMU. You guys get it going up there.
Okay. We'll start it.
So we have a number of listener questions, actually maybe a record setting. So we want to kind of go maybe quick fire on them.
I'm not sure that's a good sign.
There's so many that Rich Lamborn and Mike Wall got cut off the list. So it's a prestigious list. We cut them out. But
Rich, the first... John cut yours out. I didn't do it.
No, Billy said to. So the first one's from Aaron Mansfield, the head coach for the indoor team at LMU and my assistant. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He says, you're one of the coaches he's tried to study and learn from afar. He said you were one of the first coaches that he noticed that implemented a fast tempo offense to the pins with a slower tempo to the middles. He's wondering what were some of the things that you learned along the way as a coach that influenced this vision of running an offense like that.
Yeah, it's a good question. So first I'm going to start off with something I stole from Aaron this past weekend when we played you guys. We were switching sides and I heard him say to one of your teams, nice job serving. I think he said serving into space. And I'd never talked to my players that way, but I started to. I was like, you need to serve into space. You need to find an open space and serve there. So thank you, Aaron. When I came from the men's national team started to slow up their quick just a little bit, like just slow it up a little bit to give the middle a little more time to hit around the block, you know. And so when I went to St. Mary's, I thought, I want to do that. I want to slow it up a little bit. And Sam, my first assistant coaches were Sam Crossan and Sydney Chute, and Keegan was a student assistant. And anyway, we started just experimenting with different things, and we just felt like slowing it down to a certain tempo, if you combine that with setting fast to the pins, can be really effective. It gives your middle more time to see the block and hit around it. But, you know, you have to set fast to the pins. Otherwise, they're just going to block everything. You know, if it's slow in the middle and kind of slow outside, then you're toast. But if it's fast to the pins, you can slow it down a little bit more in the middle. It also, one of the things as coaches, we always are trying to figure out is how can we set our middle more? Well, if you set them a slower set, they'll be available more often. They have more time, especially in transition, to be available, to go hit. So we've done that. One of the biggest compliments I got in the WCC, we started setting some back twos. We played LMU years ago, and I don't remember who it was on their team who would hit kind of just naked twos in the middle, and she was so good at it because she could hit around the block. But if you helped on the block, she would just tip over the wing, and it was really hard to defend. So we thought, okay, we need to start doing it then. If it's so hard to defend, let's do it ourselves. So we started setting some kind of twos in the middle and some back twos. And the biggest compliment I got was when Tom stole that from me and started doing it at LMU. The sad part about it was when he was doing it better than us. I hated that. But he started doing that. I thought, okay, then it must be kind of good. But yeah, I think, you know, we started slowing it up a little bit in the middle, and if you can teach your hitters how to hit the crossbody shot pretty sharp and line up the wrist away shot so it's kind of easy to hit and read the block, it can be hard to stop if the middle knows how to do that. And then if they start helping on it, you set outside, and theoretically it should be fast enough outside that the wing can't really help effectively and be a good blocker out on the pin. So that's the theory, at least, and sometimes it works really well, and other times we've struggled with it. It's hard for the setters. It's really hard for a setter to be accurate and fast. You're asking a lot of your setter when you're saying you've got to fire it out there, and it's got to be really accurate because your hitter doesn't have the time to adjust your set. So that part of it's hard. And but, you know, with practice, you can. It's amazing the things you can do. I wish recently we'd been more effective with it, but there have been times it's been really effective, and, you know, coaches, either they're lying to me or they're being honest. They're saying, you know, sometimes it's really hard to defend your offense. So hopefully they're being honest.
Nice. And Jorge Panati asks, what are three characteristics that allow assistant coaches to bring their programs high value and help them move up in the ranks?
Awesome. Jorge is my volunteer assistant, by the way, and he's phenomenal. Assistant coaches, I think that the most important thing an assistant coach can do and communicate to the head coach is that they're completely, fully invested in seeing the team succeed. And so I've got two overriding things I tell my assistants. One is you've got the green light to do anything that you think will make the student athlete experience as good as it can possibly be and to help our team be successful. And you don't have to come to me all the time and say, hey, can I do this? It's good to communicate clearly so that we're all on the same page. But if you see something that needs to be done, whether it's in practice or off the court, you know, communicating with players or whatever, that you think is going to help make the student athlete experience better or make our team better, please go do it. That's what you're here for, is to do that. And so I want to show my assistants that I have a lot of trust in them, and that they, you know, the things that they bring, that they offer as a coach, I want them to use them and do that and help the team in that way. So did he say the top three things?
That's a good one. Let's make sure, just so we can get to all these. I think that's good.
Good enough?
Yeah, that'll cover it. How about we got one from Keegan Cook. I didn't realize he graduated from St. Mary's. He was a former assistant for you, and he's the current head coach at the University of Washington. He asks, what character do you value most in a player?
Wow, that's a good question. What character trait do I most value in a player? I probably selflessness, because I think selflessness can permeate so many other aspects of what they do in terms of being a leader, in terms of being a learner. I think you have to be kind of selfless to be a learner. In terms of having a growth mindset, which, you know, that's kind of the same thing, being a learner and having a growth mindset. But I think selflessness, you know, just that they're willing, that they're going to put the team above themselves, and they're going to check their ego at the door, you know, and just want to go learn. I have a bunch of great student athletes right now. There's one in particular who I admire so much, just who she is as a person. She is so selfless and just an amazing person to be around. And you know, that selflessness it permeates everything that she does and makes her a great teammate, a great person to coach, a great volleyball player. It's great. So I'm going to go with that, selflessness.
Cool. And Mandy Bible current assistant at St. Mary's, asks, what was your biggest challenge when you first started coaching collegiate volleyball, and how has it changed?
This podcast has turned into This Is Your Life. It's like everybody is like, oh, you know, yeah, that, man, yeah, Mandy is my amazing assistant coach. Sorry, I was thinking about This Is Your Life, and I didn't listen to the question. Tell me the question again.
Yeah, what was your biggest challenge when you first started coaching college volleyball, and how has it changed?
My biggest challenge was Mandy Bible.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get her, you know, in line was a task. The exact opposite was true. Mandy was the greatest thing that could have ever happened to a coach who had never coached collegiately, had never been a head coach at that level, and really, you know, needed someone like Mandy Bible on the team to help me, in addition to having Sam and Sydney there to help me out there. But when I came here to St. Mary's, there were a lot of things that were not very healthy and not very good. And they had this great season, most successful season, arguably, that St. Mary's had ever had. I say arguably because we've only won the WCC championship once, and Mandy wishes that she had won a WCC championship. But what she did her sophomore year was she led her team and took her team to the Sweet 16, and they beat Stanford twice that year, and Stanford was the eventual national champion. So they had a phenomenal year. But there was a lot of chaos on the team, and I had to just, it was kind of like herding cats. There, you know, players wanted to leave. They didn't want to play anymore. After this amazing season, you know, there just was a lot of dysfunction. And so I had to just try and keep it together. And there were a couple players that wanted to stop playing, and some transferred out, and a couple others didn't want to play anymore. And I was able to keep them on the team. And that was the hardest thing and the most important thing that I could have done. But just, you know, it takes time to implement, to develop the culture that you want to have. And it was a huge learning curve for me, just going from the men's Olympic team to women's collegiate volleyball. There were a lot of things I needed to learn. And so that was the biggest thing that I had to do, was just kind of keep the team together and get them to feel good about just being a team again and being a functional team. I don't know if I answered Mandy's question at all, but she's used to that. So
perfect. Well, we're keeping with the Bible family. Emily Bible, who plays for you now, asks, is there a specific moment in your coaching career that has shaped you?
So I wasn't going to use Emily's name, and this might embarrass her, but she's the player I was talking about, who is just so selfless and total inspirational to all of her teammates and to her coaches. So repeat the question for me, please.
John, is there a specific moment in your coaching career that has shaped you?
There have been tons of moments that I think shaped me. But let me think of a couple. When Mandy was a senior on our team, I'm trying to remember if it was her senior year or her junior year. It might have been her junior year. Mandy's mom had cancer, and her mom passed away during the season. And I know how difficult that was, that whole process, you know, knowing that her mom was so sick. The day her mom passed away, Mandy chose to play. We were playing Santa Clara, and she went out and played an amazing match. She came, I think, maybe two blocks or two kills or two something shy of having a quadruple double as a setter. Really amazing. And that was an inspirational and impactful moment for me, just how she was able to take an extremely difficult circumstance and deal with it and be there for her team. And we won a match against a really good Santa Clara team in five, and I'll always remember that. There were some being with on BYU's team, men's team, was very impactful for me because, you know, it's with those great coaches and this great group of players, just an amazingly talented and just great group of guys. And they had a really good team. All 3 years I was there, I like to tell people that they were really bad until I got there, and then, you know, I turned them around. But the truth is they were already good. And they had this good team, but they weren't quite breaking through. You know, there were still some things that kind of kept them from reaching their full potential. And I think there was a moment when, or a time when, that team just really came together and became a lot more selfless and put the team above anything else. And that was in 99 when they just, things came together and they won the national championship. And that season and that match when they won that game was just really cool and something that taught me about how important it is for a team, no matter how talented you are, to be a team, and that if you can achieve that, you can go a long ways.
Well, I think that's a good spot for us to wrap it up. Emily gave us a great question there, and she's really fun to watch. She just looks like an awesome player to have. She's always smiling. I've been blown away by when I see her play. She'll get served every ball, and she'll still have a smile on her face and play really hard. So, good question, Emily. So, Rob, thanks so much for sharing your time and all your wisdom. And I know Billy and I have been taking notes over here, and we're going to take a lot of this into our training and our practices. So really appreciate all that you shared and all you've done for volleyball.
Thank you, John and Billy. I really appreciate it. I'm flattered to be on your podcast, and it's been fun. Thank you for inviting me.
See you in the WCC championships. See you in the finals.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will, John. We will be there.
Be another fun one.
It will be.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Coach Your Brains Out. You can follow us on Twitter at Coach Your Brain or on Facebook, facebook.com/Coach Your Brains Out. If you like the show, please write us a review and spread the word.